This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Demonstrators at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville marched through the grounds of the University of Virginia, carrying flaming torches, an echo of Nazi rallies in the past. And in a modern American touch, some carried assault rifles. Just how and why they were allowed to do that is one of the questions I put to Dahlia Lithwick, the legal analyst at Slate. She hosts Slate's Amicus podcast, and she lived in Charlottesville until just a few weeks ago. Dahlia, I just want to start with Charlottesville, of course. You've lived there for a long time.
16 years. I had both my children there. All the years that I lived there, I commuted to D.C. to cover the Supreme Court, which is not an easy commute, but that's been my home for 16 years.
Dahlia, can you tell us a little bit about the run-up to the Unite the Right rally that took place in August? Talk us through what happened in the city council offices and in the courts in all the days and weeks before this event that really shook the country.
I think, David, it's useful to disaggregate a little bit the controversy about these Civil War monuments, right? We have a monument to Stonewall Jackson. We have a monument to Robert E. Lee. There's been a years-long fight about taking those down, and that's been echoed all across the country with Confederate monuments. That was one piece of it. And then there was this other piece, which is the alt-right and the flaming torches and the Nazis. So the monuments was a story that progressed the way it's progressing in a lot of small southern towns, which is that a high school student wrote a paper saying, I think these monuments stink and they should come down. The city council did this lengthy exploratory, how are we going to do this? What should we do? But ultimately, the city council voted that they were to come down. And a judge in February enjoined that for 6 months and said, there's a statute that says we can't go pulling down Confederate monuments. I'm going to give this some more thought. That's where we were when Richard Spencer and the Charlottesville iteration of Richard Spencer, a gentleman by the name of Jason Kessler, got involved and started to say, we're going to mash our issues into this fight about pulling down the monuments.
How did Jason Kessler come to have a friend in the American Civil Liberties Union?
So this turns in, as classic American stories always do, into a huge court fight. And when it becomes manifest that this rally is going to be out of control, that a lot of people are coming, that this is an open carry state, and that's important, some of them are going to be armed, the city council said, we're going to file a petition to move this thing to a satellite park that's much further away that the police can control. And this litigation goes right up until literally the day before the march. And at that point, the ACLU and the Rutherford Institute, which is another civil libertarian group in Charlottesville, both come together and say, you are persecuting this group based on their ideas and their speech. That's classic First Amendment persecution. And so they side with the Unite the Right folks and Jason Kessler and Richard Spencer and the neo-Nazis to say to the judge, you can't allow this to be moved. And in fairness, and I think this gets lost in some of the reporting, the judge takes really careful notice of the fact that the counter-protesters were not being moved. It looks as though, the judge says, the city is saying only the alt-right and the Nazis have to go to this other site. And so that starts to look a lot like it's discrimination on the basis of viewpoint or ideology, and that's what makes the judge nervous.
So is this not a free speech issue, though? Why is this not a free speech issue? We've seen Nazis and Klan people and all kinds of groups over the years march in Skokie, Illinois, and all manner of places. You don't have to like it. I despise it, but it is a free speech issue, no?
It is, and that's what the judge who looked at this initially just assessed it as a classic speech question.
Was he wrong?
No, I think that he was wrong only insofar as he either didn't take judicial notice or chose not to think about the fact that these folks had guns.
What was your experience of the August rally? Where were you? What did you see?
We were home. We have two boys who are 12 and 14. They were getting very anxious. Everybody was kind of roiling with this feeling of, should I be on the streets? I want to be on the streets, but I don't know how I feel about Antifa. I know how I feel about Antifa, but I don't want to get pepper sprayed. And so everybody was—
Antifa, the anti-fascist group, which made its presence known.
Right. And we should talk about it, because it turns out that when the police stand down in Charlottesville on August 12th, an awful lot of people, including the faith leaders, I talked to many, many clergy leaders. They were telling me, when guys came at me, you know, with clubs and with guns, Antifa saved me. And that's been a part of the story that I think we have to reckon with, too.
Was the speech of counter-protesters somehow suppressed that day?
I think that that gets to the heart of your other question, which is why this isn't a classic speech problem. If you're in an open carry state and people are carrying semi-automatic weapons and they are literally throwing, as they were on the Friday night protest, throwing gasoline and then, you know, trying to light people on fire on the counter-protesting side. And I think this is also really important, David. These were not local alt-right folks. I mean, Jason Kessler was a local alt-right.
Everybody was an import for the most part?
People came. I think that what we were hearing was 80-some percent of the people who came from not even out of town, but out of state.
On the legal side, a key question here has to be this. Is openly carrying a gun a form of protected speech, and should it be?
Yeah. I mean, that's the nut question. And I think it's the question, you know, when you asked me how the judge handled moving the rally, I think the failure was to understand that once folks are open carrying, this is no longer just a speech question. Now, we have speech doctrine, and you cited the Skokie case in the 1970s. The Nazis tried to march in Skokie, Illinois. They deliberately picked neighborhoods where Holocaust survivors were aggregated. The Supreme Court blesses this march, right? And as you said about the ACLU was on the Nazi side. And it destroyed, I mean, Jewish support for the ACLU at that time was really, really eroded.
What do you think of the Skokie case?
I think that the Skokie case was correctly decided because it was a pure speech case. I remember doing a panel about this a year ago with Ted Shaw, who used to be the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And he said the problem when the government gets involved in speech is that they start going after the white supremacists. But you know who gets totally screwed in the end of the day? It's always the black groups. It's always the minorities. It's always the workers. And so you have to analyze
how
these.
So?
Because the same systemic imbalances that exist throughout the legal system also do not necessarily protect the speech of the people we want to protect. And I take that very, very seriously. I know it sounds deranged in a moment like now, but I think that the last thing any of us wants is the government, particularly this government, to be determining what is protest, who is Antifa, and what is speech. And I think if I had to make one point about the sort of First versus Second Amendment problem here, it's that we can't analyze them separately anymore, that there are folks open carrying in a performative way now. They say, and we've had this all over Virginia.
And you see this on the streets of Charlottesville.
You see, I mean, we had people open carrying in our Whole Foods, like in the banana section. We have our Kroger, you know, is an open carry Kroger. During the 2016 election, there were folks open carrying, again, as kind of performance art, outside one of the candidates' offices, and that candidate's staff were afraid to go home. So I think until we can figure out where the line is between what looks like intimidation and threats and what is simple protected Second Amendment activity, we can sort of say all these speech problems get swallowed into that black hole. And suddenly you have people coming to Charlottesville and they are explicitly saying, I mean, the police knew that they were going to come with guns. They knew that they were.
But my understanding is that firearms are not allowed on the campus of the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. Did it seem to you that the university was insufficiently prepared for these armed protesters?
So the university is this whole separate drama. On Friday night, this is the 11th, they decided to march on the UVA campus, and they had the flaming torches, the tiki torches, right from the home furnishing section at Walmart.
And that's where they came from.
They were bringing the tiki torches, which, you know, is very, very Love Boat, but not so Love Boat when you're a student on campus and you're trying to move in. Now, there are huge factual questions about what the university knew and didn't know. And Teresa Sullivan, who has really had to answer for this in the weeks since.
This is the president of UVA.
She has taken the position, I think not unreasonably, that the university was completely blindsided when it was hundreds of people and they had torches.
How could they not know?
Well, so this is the factual question that is going to have to be unraveled. I think a lot of folks in town already knew that they were going to march on the UVA campus. And this also goes a little bit to this really interesting subset of this problem. You know, we talked about the fact this is a tiny little town. Everybody knows everybody. There's five people on the city council. But I think that the UVA town gown nexus between this college, which was, right, the Harvard of the Confederacy. I mean, this was right. A university that is very much born out of Confederate intellectual. You know, this is Jefferson. This is the heart of what becomes the resistance in the Civil War. And to be blinkered about the history of UVA in this, and that's why I think it's an error to not look at the fact that Richard Spencer and Jason Kessler are UVA alums, that they are still, I think, skating some of this problematic
history. But are you suggesting,
history.
Wait a minute, that the culture of the University of Virginia at this moment now has traces of this ideology? Either in its faculty or in its students?
Certainly not in its faculty, certainly not in its students. But I think the same failure to absolutely understand what Jefferson means to some people, what Robert E. Lee means to some people, what Stonewall Jackson means to some people. You cannot ask any university, I think, to subordinate its founding, its legacy, and to say, I want you to hate everything about what you were in order to join this century. And so I think that I don't want to by any means say that the university tacitly supports white supremacy. The university did, however, very overtly support astounding KKK and white supremacy activity in the 1920s and 30s.
The ACLU is going through its own drama. It ultimately changed its policy after the demonstration. And that's a historic moment for a group that's 97 years old, isn't it?
The ACLU got so much heat for being on the wrong side of Heather Hare's death.
But were they on the wrong side of Heather Hare's death?
Well, that's what they were accused of. That's what you're saying is exactly the right question. And their answer is, we had nothing to do with inciting violence.
How are they not wrong?
We were there for speech. I think that they were implicated in what became the legal chaos around the march. I think that they had such acute blowback. And membership saying, oh, no, 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 this isn't speech, this is violence. What you are now endorsing is intimidation, it is racial hatred, and this transcends your core mission. And within a day, the ACLU comes out and says, okay, now we're not for that speech. You know, we will now be much more careful about not protecting what looks to be violent threats. And so they received exactly the kind of blowback they got after the Skokie case, but this time they changed their position.
So what needs to change in our legal system to prevent this kind of violent confrontation in the future?
Well,
or is it just lousy policing and bad local politics?
I think the question post-Charlottesville has been, is this the beginning of something or was this a one-off? And certainly Boston suggests, and even what we saw in Northern California suggests, that at least large metropolitan police departments are now going to be very quick to police this in a different fashion. They're going to separate the two sides. There's going to be a huge buffer. You know, there are things we can do, but I think we have a really profound problem with guns, and I think certainly in open carry jurisdictions where Second Amendment folks are taking the position that it is actually a First Amendment right to carry a gun because you are communicating something, there has been a strain of, we can just stand here open carrying with our semi-automatics, and it's just speech. It's just a declaration of our deep fondness for guns.
So tell me about Charlottesville moving forward. I know you've moved to New York, and welcome.
Thank you.
But what happens to your city of Charlottesville?
So Charlottesville is first and foremost still roiled by this, still grieving acutely. My friends who I'm talking to and texting with really are still quite fearful. Richard Spencer and Jason Kessler and all the good folks who joined us in August say they're coming back. This was a huge success for them. And city council is trying to figure out what went wrong. And as I said, the university is trying to figure out what went wrong. I think a lot of people like me who didn't go out on the streets that day are going to say, maybe I have to go out on the streets the next time.
So what does a place like Berkeley have to learn from something like this? A student group has reportedly invited Ann Coulter and Milo Yiannopoulos to speak on campus. The last time Milo was there, violent counter-protesters set fires and destroyed buildings or damaged buildings, and the university was forced to cancel the speech. How do you view the Berkeley phenomenon?
I think that it's a totally different and inapposite set of problems, and I think we have to kind of analyze them differently. I'm going to continue to say on this, I am a free speech purist, that the cure for bad speech is more speech. As Justice Brandeis said, sunlight is the best disinfectant. And shutting down speeches and speakers doesn't make their ideas go away.
Dahlia Lithwick, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Dahlia Lithwick is a senior editor and legal analyst at Slate.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.